And our special guest tonight, Michael Tellinger. We're talking about his work, Slave Species of the Gods. Incredible work indeed. More to come when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, how did they clone so many humans to do all this work? I mean, and did they do it in real time, or did they like jumpstart it?
Well, that's a very good question. Thanks for asking it. And it's a tough one to get across to some people that holding on to mainframe ideas of who we are and where we come from. Once you understand and you have the ability to use genetic cloning, you can pretty much do anything. And you can mess with DNA. I mean, you know what happens with genetically modified food. The problem with genetically modified food is that they put DNA into an orange or maize that is not DNA from an orange or maize. You know, they'll use genes from completely different organisms and put them into the DNA to get a certain effect. So you can create any kind of organism if you know how to do it, how to splice DNA. And that's exactly in Sitchin's work. You know, he says very clearly that they unraveled the entwined essence. And I think, quite frankly, that the Sumerian tablet's name for the DNA is far more descriptive than DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. I mean, what on earth is that, you know?
Yeah,
what
exactly.
Is deoxyribonucleic acid? When you say the entwined essence, isn't that more descriptive? So that's exactly what they did. And they utilized various aspects of their own DNA of existing creatures on planet Earth and whatever else. We don't really know what else they put in there. But what they needed to do is to create a creature and a species, a slave species, that was capable of taking instructions, following orders, and doing the job that they needed to do. Now, when people ask, well, why didn't they just use machines if they were so advanced, you know? Well, you can't train machines to climb down a hole and fetch that over there and bring it here. You know, machines can only perform, you know, basic things. So, yes, they can be technologically advanced. You can levitate things, and you can cut. You know, you can have advanced laser beams or phaser technology that could cut incredible holes in the ground and so forth. But then somebody needs to go and do the hard work. And that's what the slaves were for. And they cloned them in what I believe to have discovered these cloning tanks here in southern Africa that are scattered among these ruins. And earlier we spoke about what were these stone structures for. Well, they clearly were not dwellings. They were all of them are energy devices. Each and every one of them that we've measured generates huge amounts of energy, so much energy that it boggles our mind. And this energy was used for the mining of gold and other minerals probably as well. And not only was the energy used for that, but the energy was also then would have been used for the cloning tanks where they were cloning these humans.
Ah.
And you ask, how long did it take to clone them? And this is information that I got out of channeled information, so this is what it is. I asked, how long did it take to clone these beings? And the answer was the normal period. So I asked, was the normal period 9 months? And the answer was yes.
Hmm. Okay, so let's assume this though, Michael. They clone them, takes 9 months from embryo to birth, basically. How long did it take to get the worker? And what do you think? What age did they start working? 15, 12, 20? What do you think? And did they have to wait that long for that to happen?
Good question. No, they didn't. They didn't clone them into babies. You can imagine. You're not going to clone babies. So you wipe their bums and wipe their noses and look after them until they're old enough to go to work in the mines.
So they came out as adults right away.
That's right. Just like in the many sci-fi movies, you see vaults of the UFOs and in the vaults somewhere, these giant amniotic sacs hanging with large humanoid beings hanging in them. That's it. That's what we're dealing with here, George.
Okay, that's it.
It's mind-blowing. And it took 9 months from zero to full-grown adults that would come out of that as a baby, obviously. So they would have to teach them to walk. That it would teach them to understand and comprehend and teach them to use the tools and the skills, and then probably within a few months or few weeks, put them to work. And that's when this becomes really important, and this is where my discussion with William Brown on the DNA and the chromosomes becomes so critical. Because the number 22 plays a very important part in all of human history and laws of nature and so forth. 22 is a key number. It even plays a role in pi. 22 over 7 is an approximation of pi and so forth. But 22 numbers in the original alphabet, 22 chapters in the book of Revelations, there are 22 frequencies that seem to be the main frequencies that they talk about in the Montauk project that they reverse engineered chair that they found there in the UFO. 22 is a very important number in all of creation. And I was under the impression that the first humans that were cloned only had 22 chromosomes. And that turns out to be actually very true. And William Brown seems to agree with that totally, the geneticist from Hawaii. And it was only when we needed to procreate ourselves, when they realized they weren't cloning these slave species fast enough, they said, hold on, we need to allow them to procreate on their own because we can't clone them fast enough. So that's when they took the famous story in the Bible when they put Adam into a deep sleep not in the Bible, the Sumerian tablets tell us a lot more detail about that. Sitchin's work, how they put Adamu into a deep sleep, they took the essence out of his rib, and I believe that would have been some bone marrow because they've already created the DNA. They're not going to go back into the lab and recreate the same kind of DNA to create a female species, right? A female partner for the male species, which incidentally also suggests that the first humans cloned were only male, all male and probably hermaphroditic without any sexual organs and asexual. And it was only when they wanted them to procreate that they took the DNA, took the essence out of the bone marrow, added the 23rd chromosome, the X and the Y chromosome, the male sex and the male and the female sex chromosomes, that they then added to the species and basically re-engineered the species and created the female counterpart so they could procreate, at which point they probably put them into this place, some sort of a garden or a observation tank or a camp where they could see how they would get on and if they would, copulate and create offspring, and if the female wouldn't eat the male after they copulated, which many species do.
That's true. They do that.
Yeah, the story of human origins gets really gruesome to people that are not prepared to hear this kind of stuff. So when they believe the beautiful story of Adam and Eve and the fairy tale kind of story, it is far from that. You mentioned something about the Anunnaki earlier as well. Remember that Enki, Adam's calendar is pretty much Enki's doing. It has got Enki's energetic imprint in it. There's a wonderful section in Sitchin's work, and he didn't know that I would find it. When he wrote it, he didn't know that we would discover Adam's calendar. And there's a translation in one of his works that says, 40 Shar after arriving on Earth, Enki built himself a special place of observing in the deep Abzu on the edge of a cliff aligned with his abode in the north and the Twin Peaks, something to that effect. And you go, my goodness, it's like we're discovering everything Sitchin wrote about in physical form. So Adam's calendar is very much Enki's doing. But what was Adam's calendar all about? And that's when all Indiana Jones movies just suddenly fell into insignificance, when you realize what this site was all about. I think, I'm not sure if in our last chat I spoke about the energy fields that we measured in these stone circles and at Adam's calendar.
Did you find a difference there?
Oh, boy. Well, first of all, the fact that these stone circles, millions of stone circles, are energy devices, I'm not speculating. I'm telling you because we know this. We measured it with very sophisticated electronic equipment, where you measure outside the circle and there's nothing, and you measure inside the circle and the machine goes, off the chart, showing you electromagnetic field. It shows you very, very high electromagnetic activity, and it even shows you whether the field is running horizontally or running vertically. And in many of these fields, the stone circles, the electromagnetic fields run horizontally, creating what would be what could be described as sort of an electromagnetic shield or a dome shield over the stone circle. And the way it's created is using the sound frequencies from Mother Earth, the same way that Nikola Tesla described in some of his work, saying that the Earth rings like a bell. And if you know how to use the sound frequencies of Mother Earth, you can convert it into, everlasting energy, free energy. And I believe that's exactly how these stone circles work. And that is why they represent cymatic patterns, very distinct and very clear cymatic shapes, each one representing the sound frequency coming out of the Earth at that point in time. So we've measured the energies, the electromagnetic frequencies, the electromagnetic waves, and the energy fields, but also sound frequencies that run into the gigahertz, George, gigahertz. Now, that's unheard of, measuring sound into the gigahertz. The only other person that really understands it that I've spoken to about this, most people that I talk about, the scientists, will look at me and they look at me like I've gone nuts. The only person that understood when I've told him that we measured gigahertz frequencies is Don Estes in Los Angeles, because he is a real expert in sound and understanding sound as a source field energy. And this is what they used. It is now totally clear to me that they had an absolute understanding of generating energy out of the natural elements around them, and then using natural elements, specifically stone and rock, to harness the energy, utilize it, focus it. I believe they created what I refer to as phaser beam technology, because I've been discovering these very strange cone-shaped tools, like ice cream cone tools that I find scattered around many of these stone ruins. And you start thinking to yourself, what on earth would they be using all these weird cone-shaped tools for? Until you realize that, hold on, the stone that they used in these structures is a very specific kind of stone, and that stone rings like a bell. And for those people that have been to my website will see the little video clips that I've put on of these stones that have phenomenal acoustic quality, and that is exactly why they use this stone.
Michael, give me your overall thoughts and impressions of just what's been going on this planet for so many years, and where we're headed. And then, of course, I'm going to ask you that ultimate question as well, is because if they've created us, who created them?
Yeah. Well, what's been going on this planet is a long, long manipulation of beings, and activity of extraterrestrial activity has been going on for a long time. You'll know that there are people that talk about there are at least 57 types of ETs that have had interaction with us humans at this stage. That gives you an idea how many ETs and extraterrestrial species have been coming to Earth for thousands and millions of years. Life on Earth is not just a few thousand years old or a few hundred thousand years old. And as that inscription in Sitchin's work, Adam's calendar, that based on that 40 Shah arrival, puts it at about 285,000 years. So Adam's calendar is 285,000 years old. But the activity on planet Earth goes back millions and millions of years, because, I've shown in a video clip on my YouTube channel that giant footprint that's about 2 hours' drive from where I live. That footprint is in rough granite, and that footprint is about 4 feet tall, which suggests that whoever made that footprint would have been about 7.5 meters, or 23 feet tall. So, the history of this planet is so strange and so different from what most of us could possibly fathom or imagine. And there are people that have made it their mission to put together a cohesive story of what you asked me, and are probably better suited to answer that question. But from my perspective, I believe that this planet has gone in various stages of being a utopian planet, like paradise on Earth, of beautiful, highly advanced, highly conscious beings, pretty much aligned and connected to unity consciousness and source consciousness and the divine source of things, very, very highly evolved consciously and spiritually. And then the fall of these beings or the decline of those beings over millions of years, and then the abuse and manipulation of those beings because they just knew no anger or no conflict or no violence, or and those beings stand a very good chance of being abused by other more malicious advanced beings that follow a philosophy of service to self rather than service to others, or contributionism, as I call it, consciousness, unity consciousness philosophy. So I believe there have been some epoch cycles. And I was just looking at the Hindu Mahabharata books and reading segments of it yesterday, started reading it again. And it clearly talks about ancient times and epochs where there were huge battles taking place in the sky between the gods and between the gods and the humans and so forth. So the history of this planet is truly far more mysterious and spectacular than most of us could imagine.
Well, pretty dramatic indeed. Now, tell me about the God. Who created them all?
Well, that's the source field. The source field energy, that's what I would call it. The divine unity, source of divine unity consciousness. And this is where the DNA becomes really important and our understanding of what DNA is today. And that DNA that shapes and molds physical matter has a very specific code imprinted in it for humanoid beings. And out of the 57 odd ETs that have been described by other researchers, all of them look pretty much the way we do. So clearly within the DNA pattern that comes out of the vacuum, it just manifests. And this is real scientific research. So the DNA pattern has some sort of a code in it that creates humans or humanoids that look pretty much like us. Well, where does that come from? All ancient cultures talk about, that the universe and all the things in the universe come out of some sort of a sound frequency. The primordial creative source of all things is constantly referred to as sound energy, the sound of God. The Christianity says God said, let there be light. The Hindus believe that the Om or Aum is the primordial creative sound that created all things, the sound of God, the divine creator. The Egyptians believed that the universe was sung into creation. And if you start looking into all ancient cultures and their belief, the creation belief, whichever way you look at it, you'll always find a reference to sound as a source of all things. It's often hidden, sometimes it's hidden, sometimes it's right in your face. So it's the sound frequency that is at the source of all things. And that sound frequency seems to manifest everything else, even light, because in the Bible it tells us, God said, let there be light. Mm-hmm. So the sound of God came before the light. And I believe in those first three books of the Bible, those first three verses of the Bible, rather, it's like the Holy Trinity of manifesting matter and manifesting reality. It's like a quick lesson in quantum physics. When sound combines with light, they activate the infinite quantum soup of possibility and manifest matter. So I think it's important for people to understand that the knowledge we are given in the ancient sacred texts, including the Bible, specifically the Bible as well, is filled with advanced knowledge and information. But what you got to do is you got to take off the soap opera off the top.
Hold on, Michael. More to come on Coast to Coast AM with you as we talk about slave species of the gods. And our special guest tonight, Michael Tellinger. We're going to come back, take some phone calls with Michael as we talk about his work, of course, the slave species of the gods. His other one, Temples of the African Gods, will come out in March of 2013. We will be back with your phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Michael Tellinger. Michael, they came here in craft. Any evidence that shows that the craft was here, that it took off, anything like that?
Well, good question. Evidence of the aircraft. Well, I haven't thought about that for a while. Good question.
It is. Landing spot, anything like that?
Oh, are you talking about, you're probably talking about the landing spots like at Baalbek, which are clearly, you know, giant ancient structures that are very, very old. Yeah, I guess Baalbek would probably be well described as a potential landing site. Yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, you mentioned the gold earlier as well. And you mentioned, and I think we need to talk about this, George, to make a possible correction or a realignment of what we've been thinking for a long time. You know, you mentioned that the Anunnaki, according to Sitchin's work, said that they were looking for the gold because they wanted to repair their planet, right?
Right.
And, well, I've got new information now that suggests something slightly different.
Oh, really? And tell me.
Oh, yeah, that it wasn't necessarily to protect their planet, but to actually shield their planet from the eyes and observation of other advanced and conscious beings in the universe, so they couldn't observe what they were doing and intending to do on this planet. Because it seems now, with more research, that the Anunnaki were not only malicious in what they were doing on this planet, but they were doing it on other planets as well.
Uh-huh.
And they were mining gold on other planets. And they used the gold in the form of white powder of gold, which you know all about, right?
Yes.
And monatomic form of gold, not the gold, shiny gold that we get out of the ground. But they used the monatomic form of gold to create a shield around their planet, to create an energetic shield that would not make their thoughts and ideas and intentions and activities and also whereabouts detectable to other conscious beings that would be unhappy with their activities here. And that changes pretty much everything that we knew up to now about the Anunnaki and their intentions. It wasn't to, you know, for their own survival, their planet is declining, is that they were just actually abusing this planet for its resources, utilizing it for their own physical well-being, their obsession with physicality and immortality. And
I long suspected that, Michael, that they were up to something else.
Yeah. And I've had two things that happened to me recently that made me realize this, and three things. First of all, I did a past life regression, and my first past life regression that I ever did was with a lady called Sandy Mack, she's the head of the American Dowsers Association, and she's a wonderful woman. I spoke at their conference in Vermont earlier this year, and she took me through past life regression and my activities here in the ancient gold mines of the Anunnaki, and I was also involved in Atlantis at some stage as a female scientist working on sound, as researching sound, which I found quite fascinating. And one of the things that came up out of this past life regression was that they were using the white powder of gold to shield their planet, and that there actually are two planets, not just one so-called Nibiru, that they're actually in a binary system around each other, and we confuse them all the time. Not only that, but then there was a young Polish boy that I read about him probably about a year ago for the first time, that suddenly at 7 years old, out of the blue, started talking about his life on another planet, a past life on another planet, and a group called the Anunnaki that came there and enslaved them to mine the gold.
Isn't that so? Now, where else would he hear that story?
Yeah, exactly. So it looks like, and the boy, the seven-year-old Polish boy, starts to talk about the Anunnaki, the enslavement of these people on their planet. I think they were called the Inuit or Inuits or something like that, and the fact that he knew and that they were doing it on other planets. And then, while I was doing a presentation in Minneapolis, after my presentation, one of the senior researchers for one of the MUFON movements there came to me and told me a remarkable story about a farm that he'd been investigating for a number of years at that stage, a farmer and his wife who had a number of ETs living on the farm in their forest, on their farm. And he says they've got video footage of everything you can imagine, you know, beings of all shapes and sizes, little ones, big ones, crafts appearing, disappearing, flying in, hovering, ETs coming in and out of the craft and just, you know, disappearing and dematerializing. And this farmer has been communicating, or they've been communicating with him telepathically. And he's okay with that, you know, somehow. And when he was there, before he left, he asked the farmer, ask them about the Anunnaki. And the farmer had to write it down, because at that stage, you'd never heard about the Anunnaki. And the MUFON chap wasn't even 10 minutes away in his car when the farmer phoned him and said, look, this is what they told me about the Anunnaki. He said, they have committed a great sin against all of humanity. Wow. And for that, for what they've done here on Earth, they've been cast out of the Book of Life by other beings of consciousness.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, and it all starts to fall into place. You know, we are really a species in great trouble, and we're not in great trouble because of our benevolence and because of our loving nature and our loving humanness. We're in trouble because we are manipulated and controlled and abused beyond our wildest belief. Every aspect of our lives, every aspect of our humanness has been hijacked and abused, not just recently. This has been going on for thousands and thousands of years. And it was really that this discovery and my discoveries here in South Africa, linking it to the Anunnaki and the gold mining, and, you know, for people that still don't get it, all our entire human existence and the reason we're here is for one reason only. In this form and shape that we're in today, is for the mining of gold. And it still continues.
It still continues,
As I told you, we don't know what happens to the gold once it leaves the gold mine.
Michael, let's go to some phone calls here for you. We'll go to Marianne first in Polson, Montana, west of the Rockies. Marianne, hi.
Hello.
Good to have you with us.
Good morning. I'm calling to tell you, first of all, I've been studying all of the ancient manuscripts and the Bible for many years, and I'm 70. You know, something you don't hear in churches, that I've never heard in churches, is something you are speaking of here about the fallen angels. When Lucifer was cast out of heaven, he was cast out with a third of the heavenlies that went with him, a third of the angels. He was the first created being, the first angel ever created, the most beautiful angel ever created. He was also the leader of music. He also, very interesting enough, was leader of half of the army of the heavens. Now, why in the world would they need an army in heaven unless somewhere in the universe there was an evilness to start with?
What do you think of that, Michael?
Yeah, thanks very much for that. You know, one's got to be very careful how we interpret these things. I believe all the stories in the Bible are directly linked to the information that we get in the tarot cards, in the major arcana and the rest of the tarot cards. But in there is encoded pretty much all the knowledge of all times and the universe, the laws of nature, the nature of reality. All of it is encoded in that. And I know this really, really well from my work and contact with the brilliant Willem de Swart, and I might have mentioned him before to you. And Willem has decoded pretty much all the numeric, what I call the secret numbers of God, everything in creation and the archetypes and the relationships and the numbers, how it all fits together, why, you know, why we have numbers and the geometry of nature and everything is just, he's got such a grasp and understanding of it, and I've gained a great deal of knowledge from him from working with him for the past 5 years. And just by what you mentioned there, that Lucifer was the first one to be cast out of so-called heaven. You know, we've got to ask ourselves, well, what is heaven? When they say they're relating to heaven, what is heaven? And he was cast out with one third of the army. Now you got to pay very close attention to the numbers that are mentioned here, because everything in our reality is driven by numbers and geometry and the relationships and the ratios of the numbers and the geometry. And when you hear the word one third, what you need to understand very, very quickly is that one third is directly opposed to, you know, the rest, which is six. So one third, two thirds of that would be six, right? So you got this is where the ratio of 333 and 666 become very important. And this is directly linked to sacred geometry and the laws of nature that make up all the stuff through sacred geometry. And 333 and 666 are the two numbers that seem to manifest physical creation, which is represented by 333, and 666, which represents the other dimensions, the stuff on the other side of the void, of the black hole, of the vacuum. And so when you hear that Lucifer was created as one of the first angels and cast out with one third of the army, you realize that we're talking about the physical manifestation, the 333 ratio, which is the Holy Trinity, linked to Holy Trinity. God said, let there be light, and created the heavens and the earth. And you see the ratio. It's really important to understand these things and not get caught up in the what I referred to earlier as the soap opera that is put on top of the important spiritual and scientific and metaphysical information that's encoded in the numbers and the sacred geometry.
Let's go to John, truck driving in Ohio, first-time caller. John, good morning. Go ahead.
Morning, George. Morning, Michael. It's an honor. First-time caller, thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you are welcome.
Michael, you were talking about sound waves emanating from the circles and that sound in the gigahertz range. Typically, humans only hear up to about 10,000 hertz. My question, I guess, is what would a human have to do to downgrade that, you know, convert that sound energy in a gigahertz range to something intelligible that we can make sense of? Does that kind of make sense to you, what I'm asking there?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because it's important to describe that. First of all, humans can hear a little bit more than 10 kilohertz. We can hear up to, some people, it all depends how good your ears are. Some people can hear up to 20 kilohertz, 20,000 hertz. Animals, obviously, dogs hear a lot higher. But then we get into, as you go up into the higher frequencies, beyond the 22,000 hertz, 25,000 hertz, humans can't hear anything. So we don't hear it. That doesn't mean the sound frequency isn't there. The sound frequencies are still there. This is a big question, the big argument, because we don't normally go and measure sound frequencies that we can't hear, because we don't really need them. And a good example would be bats. Bats use sound frequencies or sonar to catch the insects and so forth. Well, we don't hear the sound frequencies that the bats use when they fly around us, right? And so frequencies go into very, very, sound frequencies go into incredibly high frequencies, but we don't hear them and we don't work with them. Well, we're told we don't work with them. I wouldn't be surprised if the Black Ops, secret Black Ops project worked extensively with sound frequencies, because that's when you start getting into very interesting, exciting aspects of sound. The higher the frequencies get. So, and remember that the higher the frequency, the higher the energy of that frequency.
That's right. May they have used the sound as a weapon, Michael?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this comes back to a very recent discovery. Only 3 years ago, I think it is now, 2.5 years ago, in June 2009, I think it was, that scientists, our modern-day scientists, discover what they refer to as phaser technology as opposed to laser technology, right? Now, phaser technology is basically taking sound and focusing sound into what could be described as a sound laser beam. And they get very excited about it because they talk about, you know, sound frequencies that they're getting. They, for the first time, they're propelling sound into the terahertz frequencies. And guess what they say? They say, oh, this is very exciting because the applications of this phaser technology is going to be really important in our military, right? Of course. So sure. what I was referring to earlier, George, was all the stone tools and the stone artifacts I've been collecting. The cone-shaped tools and that I've been finding, what I refer to as ice cream cones in some of my presentations, are actually the key indicators here, because they suggest to me that they would have used these cone-shaped tools made out of the Hornfels stone, which is a very special kind of stone, which is very high in iron content and has very strong acoustic properties. As I mentioned, the stones ring like bells, so they conduct sound beautifully. If you use these cone-shaped stones, the same way in phaser technology, the same way that you would use crystals in laser technology, because at the tip of a laser, you put a crystal, and that crystal focuses the light into a light beam. What do you need to focus sound into a sound beam, something that conducts sound very well? And here we have cone-shaped stones that make no sense cone-shaped stones found inside or near stone circles that emit huge amounts of sound energy that make no sense. The only conclusion that I could reach is that they use these cone-shaped stones in phaser beam-type technology to focus the sound frequencies that they could use as laser sound lasers to, you know, cut into hard rock or levitate things with. I don't know if some of your listeners would have seen some of the YouTube clips of how sound levitates things. There's now some beautiful examples of sound levitation. So for those that still don't believe or don't understand that sound can actually levitate physical objects.
I believe it can.
Yeah, exactly. It's all the power of sound. So you can levitate rocks with sound, and that's what I believe so firmly. They use sound as their source of energy and their source of their tool. And also possibly their weapons.
Possibly so. Let's go to Tyler in Chicago. Get you in here. Tyler, go ahead.
How's it going? I just have two quick questions for you. First, I've, you know, like any person that's been following, like the Anunnaki or Nibiru, there's a lot of videos on YouTube of people that are going out around, you know, sunrise or noon, and they're putting a lens, like a dark lens on their cameras, and you're seeing like a big star glowing kind of right up to like the northwest side of the sun. Wanted your comments on that and whether you thought maybe it was just a lens flare or a star or a planet, or if it is actually Nibiru. And two, before you were talking about how they would clone, you know, human beings, and, you know, they basically start as adults and farm. Now, what would their soul situation be? I mean, did these beings have...
That's a good question. We're going to come back to those questions in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.